And I'm going to need help with this. He doesn't look good. Reese cut Ali's right biosuit leg off with trauma shears as Haley pulled the ambulance to the side of the road under the overpass. She kept the vehicle running and joined Reese in back.
Okay,
she said, pulling on rubber gloves and assessing the wound, noting Reese had used the tape from the trauma kit to tie Ali's hands and legs to the gurney. Blood pumped from the wound, covering Reese, Haley, the gurney, and floor of the ambulance.
This vein runs under the adductor muscle and medial, and the nerve runs lateral, exposing the artery, she said to herself, thinking back to her time in the ER during rotations. VAN, vein, artery, nerve, medial to lateral, 3 inches below the inguinal ligament.
What does that mean? Reese asked, unable to control the urgency in his voice.
It means the tourniquet is not working. He's going to be dead in minutes, if not seconds.
Shit, let's clamp it.
Find the clamps in any IV bags. They are in here somewhere,
she said, turning to go through the drawers and cabinets behind her. Reese did the same, rummaging through the unfamiliar space on his side. Ali's eyes fluttered open and he managed a weak moan.
Don't you worry, Ali. We are going to save your life, but only so you can answer questions.
Found the IV bags, Haley said.
And I think these are the clamps, Reese said, grabbing the longest tool from a drawer labeled hemostat.
Those will work,
Haley responded. She looked down at the wound, still spitting blood.
I can't see or do anything through that hole. Just hold the pressure. It will take me a second to get this set up, she said.
Reese pushed back down on the wound with both hands, looking into Ali's glassy eyes. He was on the verge of unconsciousness.
We have to stop this bleeding, she said.
Reese removed his hands from the terrorist's leg, blood continuing to pump from the body.
Damn it, Haley said. I can't see in there. The puncture wound is too small.
As she finished her sentence, Reese unsheathed his knife and stuck the tip in the hole, slicing up and then down Ali's leg to enlarge the wound. Ali's eyes opened wide and he gasped in pain.
Reese, what are you doing?
Haley shouted. Now you can see it. Clamp it, he said, handing her the hemostat. Haley took a breath to clear her head.
Haley, this man is responsible for the deaths of thousands and is the key to saving millions more. Clamp it.
Haley grabbed the hemostat from Reese and jabbed it into Ali's leg, using her free hand to manipulate the wound to give her better access. Ali's screams filled the interior of the ambulance.
Shit, she said. Probably clamped the nerve.
Haley repositioned herself and steadied her breathing.
Vein, artery, nerve, she repeated as she clamped down again, bringing the arterial pump to a stop.
Yes, nice work, Reese said.
He needs fluids or we are going to lose him.
Haley pulled a bag of lactated Ringer's solution from a drawer along with an 18-gauge IV needle, twisting his left arm taped to the gurney in an attempt to find a vein.
Did you have to tape him up? Hard to get a stick like this.
Reese slashed the tape with his fixed blade.
Better?
Better,
Haley confirmed.
Just need the right angle, she said, missing the sticks on her first three attempts.
Jesus, where did you go to medical school?
Fuck you, Reese. His veins are collapsing. There is nothing to put it in. I can't get a stick.
What about the subclavian vein? Reese asked.
And where did you go to medical school?
I saw a PJ do it in Iraq, saved my friend's life.
All right, I haven't done one since my third year of med school, but let's try.
Haley switched positions as Reese retaped Ali's hands to the gurney. She assessed the patient's upper chest and neck. Feeling her way around the clavicle, she placed her index finger in the sternal notch and her thumb at an angle to guide the needle.
Here goes,
she said, inserting it just below the clavicle and above the first rib. She was rewarded with an instant return of dark blood. Ali let out a groan. With a spurt of venous blood returning to the syringe, she hooked up the IV, wiped sweat from her forehead, and squeezed half the IV bag into the man on the gurney. Haley leaned back against the drawers in the cramped space of the ambulance. The three of them were covered in blood, but all were alive.
You drive. I'll take it from here, Reese said.
What are you going to do? She asked.
Whatever I have to.
Chapter 57. Ali watched, obviously still in intense pain. Breathing labored as Reese read the labels on bottles from the narcotics locker. Haley drove in silence, concentrating on getting them to the private side of the airport and back to the CIA Gulfstream, putting up a mental barrier between herself and what was going on in the rear of the ambulance.
"I know you," Ali whispered.
Reese turned his attention from the medical cabinet to the terrorist strapped to the gurney.
"Yeah? I do tend to get around. I saw your car in Chicago, and I saw you in Atlanta. You should be dead."
Reese paused, considering his next move.
"I know you too. Dr. Ali Reza Ansari, Biodyne, originally from Iran."
"You know nothing,"
Ali said, forcing a confident smile.
"I have a few pieces, but I don't know everything. You are going to fill in some blanks for me."
"It's too late. I know. You are not going to let me live. I am just an innocent Muslim targeted by the xenophobic American intelligence community, a victim of a systemically racist government."
"Yeah, well, the Ministry of Truth might be on your side. Unfortunately for you, I found a bottle of succinylcholine in the fridge here. Do you know what that is?"
Ali's eyes widened. He was familiar with the drug. "I was just sent a file with your resume. Very impressive. With a background like that, I bet you know all about succinylcholine.
I don't even have to tell you what it does," Reese informed his subject. Reese knew it well. It had been a favorite of the CIA doctors assigned to his covert action unit in Iraq. They had developed techniques that left no physical marks on the body. This was one of them. The American public was familiar with waterboarding. They had never read an article or heard talking heads debate the merits or legalities of this technique. Waterboarding had nothing on what Reese was preparing to do. "In case you need a refresher course, it's a muscle paralytic, meaning that it's going to paralyze every muscle in your body. You will be able to hear, see, and feel everything, but you will not be able to move. Most notably, you will not be able to breathe."
Ali shifted nervously in his restraints.
"You cannot do this to me. I am a Swiss citizen. I demand to see an attorney and a representative at the consulate."
"Unfortunately, I am not with the FBI, the police, or any agency who gives a shit. Let's see if this stuff works as well as I remember."
Reese held up a bag valve mask.
"Do you know what this is?" he asked.
"Of course you do. You're a doctor. It's an Ambu bag, an artificial respirator."
Reese extracted 50 milligrams of succinylcholine from a bottle into a syringe and injected it into the IV port. Ali's eyes widened again, and he thrashed in an attempt to free his hands of the duct tape. "It might take a second or two to fully take effect," Reese advised, pulling a strip of silver duct tape from the roll. 10 seconds later, Ali went limp as the drug paralyzed his body to include the organs that facilitated breathing.
"You won't be able to open your eyes on your own, so this will ensure you can see everything I'm doing," Reese said, taping Ali's eyelids open. "I'd hate for you to miss out. When this first dose wears off, I'll have some questions. If you answer them to my satisfaction, I might let you live. If you don't, well, there is plenty of succinylcholine for us to keep this up. For hours, maybe even days. I can carve you up, remove fingers, toes. I might even cut your balls and dick off. You won't be able to move, but you will feel and see, that I assure you. Don't worry, though. I don't think that will be necessary. Taking your air will be all I need to do."
As Ali's ability to breathe shut down completely, Reese gave him 30 seconds before leaning over and placing the self-inflating Ambu bag over his nose and mouth, squeezing it to give him a life-sustaining breath.
"Reese, what are you doing back there?"
Haley asked nervously from the driver's seat.
"I'm not sure you want to know."
"Jesus, Reese.
Just drive."
Reese lifted up one of Ali's fingers, confirming there was no muscle tone. The succinylcholine was working exactly as intended. Reese came off the breathing bag and watched Ali's eyes. The man was alive but had no control of his body. The very breath that sustained life now came from an infidel. Reese wiped the blood from the face of his Rolex and counted the second hands ticking away. On average, it takes 4 to 6 minutes for the brain to die of oxygen starvation. With all your blood loss, it will probably be a lot less. At the one-minute mark, Reese gave Ali another breath. Ali, I already know the virus is Marburg variant U. Your little helper broke, like all you warriors of Allah. Tough when you were blowing up women and children or beheading prisoners, but weak little bitches when put to the test. When this dose wears off, all you need to do is tell me where it came from and if or how it transmits from human to human. I also want to know who came up with this plan and why. If we can work our way through that, we will take you to the hospital. If not, you are going to the morgue. Reese gave Ali another breath as he began to stir, the paralytic diluting enough for him to begin breathing on his own, the resolve in his eyes replaced by fear. "You are going to talk to me, Ali," Reese said, drawing a second dose from the bottle. Ali muttered something inaudible. "That's not clear enough, Ali," he said before injecting another 50 milligrams into the IV. Reese looked back at his watch. At the 3-minute mark, he gave Ali a breath, forcing precious air into the lungs and brain of a man dying in silent terror from suffocation, unable to do a thing about it. Haley turned in her seat.
"Reese, feel his forehead."
"It's hot. He's burning up."
"Shit. Malignant hyperthermia."
"What's that?" Reese asked.
"It's a side effect of multiple doses of that drug you were giving him."
Reese gave him another breath.
"Damn it, Reese. He's going to hit 107 and seize. You are going to kill him before you get what we need."
"What can I do?"
"Look in the locker for something called dantrolene."
Reese pulled the breathing bag from Ali's face and frantically searched the locker, reading labels and throwing bottles to the side.
"Could it have another name?"
he shouted as Haley sped down the highway.
"Possibly. Dantrium, dantamacrin, or dantrolene."
"Shit, I just tossed dantrium," Reese said, scrambling to the discarded bottles rolling around on the floor of the moving vehicle until he found what he was looking for.
"Got it." "Good. Inject 20 milligrams into the line."
Reese pushed the drug into the IV port and gave Ali another breath as the muscle paralytic wore off. Haley leaned across the seat and jerked a Yeti cooler from the floor of the passenger side onto the seat. Opening the lid, she pulled out a sandwich and dropped it to the seat. She fished around inside with her right hand and removed a Gatorade and 2 artificial ice packs.
"Put these in his armpits and groin to help him cool down," she said, tossing them back to Reese.
Ali gasped as the ability to breathe on his own slowly returned. He had never been so utterly helpless, at the complete mercy of another.
Who was this American devil?
He thought of his brother hanging from the noose. Had he regretted his decision to take his own life? Had he desperately tried to loosen the rope that constricted the blood and oxygen to his brain? Ali wondered if he would shit and piss himself the way his brother had.
"What are you thinking about, Ali? Ready to go another round?"
"It came from Angola."
"What was that?" Reese asked, hitting the voice recorder on his phone.
"It came from Angola, or it came from a lab here in America, grown by a radicalized U.S. citizen named Sebastian Phillips. I was only here for a job interview. That's the story that this country will believe."
Without hesitation, Reese injected 75 milligrams of the paralyzing muscle agent into the IV and watched first the seconds and then the minutes tick by on his watch. He imagined the MC-130s taking off from Hurlburt, the pilots vectoring toward their targets, dropping the Moabs on citizens of their own country. He saw Lauren and Lucy playing together at a park in Coronado, looking up at an unfamiliar whistling sound as the bomb vectored in to explode overhead. Lauren became Katie, rushing to Lucy to shield her with her own body, Lucy's curiosity turning to terror, screaming as the fuel air explosive burned their bodies from existence.
"Reese!"
screamed Haley, jolting Reese back to the present.
"I'm here, I'm here."
"He's seizing!"
Haley yelled, twisting in her seat.
"Fuck!"
Reese pushed the breathing device onto Ali's face and started squeezing, forcing air in and out of his lungs.
"Come on, fucker, I'm not done with you yet,"
he said, the vision of Lauren, Lucy, and Katie seared into his consciousness. Reese slipped his fingers to the side of Ali's neck.
"No pulse. Hit him with the AED,"
Haley yelled.
"Shit.
Wait," Haley ordered.
"Give him Valium first."
"Valium where?" Haley turned in her seat.
"Try that drawer,"
she said, pointing.
"Got it. How much?"
10 milligrams right into the IV port." Reese drew what was close to 10 milligrams and pushed it into Ali's body through the IV. He then reached for the automated external defibrillator and attached the AED pads to Ali's chest, one on the right side just below the collarbone, and the other on the lower left side of his body below the heart. He was thankful that before his last deployment, all SEALs were required to add automated external defibrillator training to their pre-deployment workup checklist. Reese flipped the switch, bringing the machine to life, and followed the audio prompts. He hit the Analyze button. At the Stand Clear prompt, Reese leaned back as a jolt of electricity surged through Ali's chest. Nothing.
Shit! Hit him again!
Haley shouted from the front of the ambulance. Reese repeated the procedure and brought Ali back from the dead.
"He's got a heartbeat and he's breathing," Reese reported. "His body can't take much more, Reese."
"Ali, listen to me. I can do this for days. You want to suffocate for days, I'll keep you alive as long as it takes." Reese extracted another 75 milligrams of succinylcholine, deliberately, so that Ali could process what was about to happen. The assassin saw his brother hanging from the beam in his home, looking up at him for hours until his mother had returned. The wailing of his mother.
"It was a brilliant plan," Ali whispered.
"What?" Reese said, hitting his phone's audio recorder.
"Brilliant. Even with this forced confession. Brilliant."
"Whose plan, Ali?"
"It was my plan. Nothing can stop it now. That traitor, Monica Witt, planted the seed. Destroy your own cities. The Soviets had those plans too, you know."
"Witt? The Air Force sergeant?"
"There is no stopping this now. I might just be telling you what you want to hear, so that your president calls off the bombing, so that the virus spreads and destroys you."
"Is it a respiratory spread virus?" Ali paused, considering his answer.
"No. But can you trust my word?"
"How did it get into the United States?" Ali paused and Reese injected the drug back into his system.
"Almost there, Reese,"
Haley reported, taking the exit for the airport. Reese counted 3 minutes and 30 seconds on his watch, then gave Ali a breath.
"Just give me a name, Ali. Give me a name and I'll end this."
Ali's eyes darted back and forth, pure, unadulterated panic gripping his soul as the drug wore off and allowed him to breathe.
"Here's an easy one," Reese said. "What did you mean when you said I should be dead?"
Through the confusion of the fever burning up his brain, the oxygen deprivation, and visions of his brother swinging from the rope, Ali whispered a name.
"Hafez Qasem."
Ali's eyes rolled back into his head, and his body contorted against the duct tape.
"Shit, he's seizing again," Reese shouted.
"Try the AED.
Reese turned on the machine and followed the prompts. This time, the jolts did not return Ali from the dead. Reese transitioned to CPR as Haley rocketed toward the airport. After 5 minutes of chest compressions where Reese felt ribs breaking under the pressure, he tried the AED in a last-ditch effort to revive the terrorist.
"It's done, Reese."
Reese fell back into the side bench seat, completely spent and exhausted.
"It doesn't spread human to human. We can tell the president to call off the strikes," Haley said, turning down a street leading to the private government terminal.
"What if he was lying?"
"He wasn't lying, Reese."
Reese picked up his phone and sent the recording to Vic.
"I don't think it's enough.
For Christ's sake, Haley said. What else do we need?
Reese looked at the dead body still attached to the gurney covered in the blood, IV attached to his arm, the bottle of succinylcholine. Drugs. Vaccines. Bioweapons. Reese's phone buzzed with a message from Vic.
Final option. Noon tomorrow. Director is taking this information to the White House. We'll need scientific evidence to back up claims.
Reese texted back.
Hafez Qasem?
His phone buzzed a minute later.
Iranian intelligence. Chief of station in D.C. Works from Pakistani embassy.
Put a team on him, Reese typed.
Roger. RTB.
What did he say?
Haley asked.
RTB.
RTB?
Return to base, Reese said, closing his eyes and processing everything he'd learned.
Before we do pass that cooler back, he said.
It's empty.
Perfect, Reese said, pulling it into the back of the ambulance. Park up ahead and get out of the car. You saw me in Chicago and Atlanta. Iranian hit team in Maryland. Hafez Qasem. Iranian intelligence.
Haley pulled into a parking space in the government terminal, turned off the ambulance, and got out of the vehicle, leaving Reese alone to finish the job. Part 3. Eradication. The roaring of lions, the howling of wolves, the raging of the stormy sea, and the destructive sword are portions of eternity too great for the eye of man. William Blake, Proverbs of Hell. Chapter 58. CIA Gulfstream 550. Reese hadn't said much since they'd gone wheels up. He offered Haley the first shower and sat staring out the window at 45,000 feet as the Rolls-Royce engines pushed them toward the country's capital at Mach 0.85. They had packed overnight bags, so at least there were clean clothes to put on. The G-550's cabin was separated into three living areas with lavatories at each end of the aircraft. When Haley emerged, toweling off her wet hair, she noticed that the cooler Reese had brought on board was by the ice maker. It was wrapped with duct tape.
You want a drink?
Haley asked, sliding in across from Reese at the four-seat conference table.
Huh?
Reese asked, still deep in thought.
You know, a drink?
Haley asked, tipping her hand with an imaginary cocktail.
Yeah. Maybe another water.
I'll join you,
she said, leaning across the aisle and grabbing two waters from the fridge.
I need to apologize to you, Reese.
What for? I should be the one apologizing to you after what I just put you through.
First, you didn't put me through anything. Secondly, we are here because of my theory, remember?
Good point. Apology accepted.
Haley laughed. She could tell he was spent. The fighting, the fire, the torture, the knowledge that what he did or didn't do determined the fate of the nation.
As I was saying on the apology front, I had a preconceived notion of who you were, who my best friend was dating. Katie and I have known each other for a long time, and I can get protective.
Believe me, I understand, Reese said.
I had this vision of an ex-SEAL. Do you guys not say ex? It's so confusing with Marines. I think you don't say ex with them, maybe former?
I agree with you. It's confusing with Marines.
Anyway, I watched the news 3 years ago like everyone else. I couldn't figure what Katie saw in you. She's never felt this way about anyone.
Really? Reese said, suddenly more alert.
Really. So here's my apology. I saw myself as a doctor dedicated to saving lives around the globe. Médecins sans frontières and all that, battling infectious diseases on the front lines. I looked down on the military because it seemed our missions were so diametrically opposed. You take lives and I save them. I admit to being a bit of an elitist. Just ask my husband. He's the conservative one and I'm the hippie flower child. Our marriage works, though.
He's a doctor at Fort Detrick, right?
That's right. He does what I do for CDC, but he does it for the Army. Well, not exactly the same thing. We are flip sides of the same coin. He's working on vaccines for soldiers and citizens infected with bioagents. I study naturally occurring infectious diseases and trace them to their index cases so we can better understand how they start, how they spread, and how we can stop them.
I have nothing but respect for what you and your husband do, Reese said. Haley studied the dark green eyes of the man across from her.
I know why you do what you do, Reese. I saw it today.
I just don't see another way.
We are close, but we are on the clock.
I have been processing the events of the past few hours. Without you, we would not have the information we do. We'd only have my theory.
Speaking of processing, let's do a hot wash.
A what?
Haley asked. Hot wash. An informal after-action report. To go through what we learned today so we can apply the lessons going forward.
Like an operative report?
I don't know what that is.
A report that goes in a medical record post-surgery documenting the procedure.
Yeah, like that.
Let's start with my theory. This is not a naturally occurring virus.
Starting there, we now have two people involved in the plot confirming that you are correct. Downrange, I'd verify those reports via two separate and distinct independent networks to ensure we were not getting played.
What do you mean?
In Iraq and Afghanistan, there were those who saw us as a way to settle what were sometimes centuries-old feuds. Could be because someone stole someone else's great-great-grandfather's goat. Anyway, they would tell us that so-and-so was Al-Qaeda or Jaish al-Mahdi, so we would go pay them a visit in the middle of the night. We got wise to it pretty quickly, but it was something we always had to take into account when evaluating intelligence. In this case, Shahram and Ali were not independent intelligence sources, as they were working together.
I see.
So ideally, I'd want confirmation via two unrelated human, as in human intelligence, networks, and then substantiated via some technical means like phone calls, text messages, or emails.
So you think that Shahram and Ali might have had this story concocted to mix in just enough doubt that we couldn't trust them?
I think that's a distinct possibility and one that our intelligence agencies will certainly highlight when briefing the president. He is going to need solid proof that by avoiding this action, he's not condemning 90% of the country to death.
How do we verify their admissions?
Let's go back a second, Reese said. First, why disguise it as a naturally occurring virus?
To hide the perpetrator.
So who has Marburg variant U in their arsenal?
Russia, China, North Korea, and Iran,
Haley confirmed. All countries that could potentially sell it to a terrorist organization, Reese said, thinking aloud.
Maybe they didn't sell it to a terrorist organization. Maybe they perpetrated the attack.
Then they'd be culpable, Reese said.
True.
Which means we could retaliate.
Also true.
Haley, do you know what's on the table as a response to an attack on this country using a weapon of mass destruction? WMD is defined as nuclear, chemical, and you guessed it, biological weapons.
Nuclear response,
Haley correctly guessed. That's right. By mimicking a respiratory spread of a naturally occurring virus, a country or group could turn us against ourselves.
If they knew about the FAE option, Haley said.
You saw it yourself in Africa. There are very few secrets left in the world, and if you created the U.S. or USSR bioweapon programs after World War II, you would have put protocols in place to stop the spread of one of your own weaponized diseases.
Protocols that included destroying your own cities,
Haley said, completing the thought. I think so. We've learned we have plans in place to destroy sections of the country to contain a spread. I'm sure the Russians did, too.
Knowing that, who is behind this? Maybe a better question is, what would you do if you were planning this attack?
Reese paused and looked out the window. I'd look to the past.
Meaning?
What has the enemy learned by watching us in Iraq and Afghanistan over the past 20 years? What did they learn before that by watching us react to terrorism of the 60s, 70s, 80s, and 90s?
Well,
they learned that proxies work, Reese said, answering his own question. Iran has been at war with us for over 40 years. Longer if you take it back to the CIA coup in 1953. Ali Ansari is from Iran. He mentioned Hafez Qasem before he died. Qasem is the lead Iranian intelligence chief in the United States. I was involved in tracking down what may have been an Iranian terrorist network before the virus hit. I think that's why Katie and I were targeted.
Slow down, Reese. You were making the case that Iran used a proxy group to release a bioagent in the U.S. so we would think it was spreading naturally.
That's right. If we buy that it's from Angola, there are no Iranian fingerprints. If we buy that it's homegrown radicalized citizens, then we still have no one to retaliate against but ourselves. Iran remains clean, just like they have for the past 40 years, using Hezbollah and Quds Force operatives to do their dirty work.
Reese, we need to prove beyond a shadow of a doubt that this is a bioweapon and that it is not a respiratory spread virus.
Can we just look up Marburg variant U in the gene book or compare a picture or something? He asked.
It doesn't work that way. Back when the Soviets weaponized Marburg, gene sampling or other electronic microscope documentation didn't exist. We only have samples from more recent outbreaks, and besides, you would have to compare the two physical samples. We need the genome of the sample, not just a photo.
So we need a live sample of a weaponized Marburg variant U virus next to a current sample from an infected patient from today? Reese asked, wrapping his mind around the problem.
Exactly. I need a sample of the original virus, the original Marburg variant from Soviet days. We do a side-by-side genomic evaluation. If there is no variance, then we will have established that this is an intentional bioweapon release on U.S. soil. It would also confirm that it had to have been released through aerosolized droplets by a pressure source, like the example of perfume in a mall.
So, we need the original Soviet strain.
Was that a statement or a question?
Haley asked.
Regardless, good luck finding it.
Luck is the residue of preparation, Reese whispered, his eyes focused past the clouds, beyond the windows.
What?
Just something an old commanding officer of mine used to say. He turned back to Haley. One more time, who do we know has Marburg variant U in their arsenals?
Russia, for sure. And we suspect China, North Korea, and Iran.
And the United States, Reese said, working the problem.
Never confirmed, but yes, the United States.
We need that Soviet sample, Reese said, thinking out loud.
And how do you suggest we get our hands on a top-secret bioweapon that the U.S. may or may not have developed in violation of several international treaties?
We are going to steal it.
Are you sure you are just drinking water?
Haley, what exactly does your husband do at Fort Detrick?
He studies Level 4 weaponized pathogens.
Pathogens that the United States officially does not weaponize?
Reese,
how do you think he'd feel about committing treason?
Chapter 59. Masada Security Solutions Corporate Office, McLean, Virginia.
What can I get for you, Senator?
Sawyer asked. They were sitting in Sawyer's office on the top floor of the Masada corporate building, a short drive from both Langley and the Pentagon.
Something expensive, now that it's finally on your dime.
Fortunately for you, all the selections are expensive, as you put it. How about a martini?
That would be ideal.
Vodka or gin?
Gin, of course. Bombay Sapphire with three olives, if you would be so kind.
Sawyer made the drink in a chilled glass at his private office bar. He then poured himself a Hennessy Paradis Imperial and sat down in a leather chair adjacent to the sofa where Senator Thwaite now made himself comfortable, opposite an 86-inch flat screen set to a cable news channel.
"Shouldn't you be in lockdown in the Capitol building for briefings from the executive branch?"
Sawyer asked. Thwaite rolled his eyes.
"You best be careful, Senator. You know how the media loves catching politicians breaking their own rules. It makes for great content."
"That's why I'm here in this secure building with you and not getting photographed out at the French Laundry or getting my hair done like those jackasses in California."
Sawyer stifled a laugh.
"It's almost on. Where's the unmute button on this thing?"
the senator asked,
examining the remote control in his hand as if it were a foreign object. "Let me," Sawyer said, swiping to his phone's Savant system application, which bypassed the remote on the coffee table.
"You know, you should invest in some less depressing art," Thwaite remarked, looking around the room.
"Oh, and what would you suggest?"
"Something a little less morbid would spruce things up in here," he said, gesturing to the two large works that dominated the room, one behind the bar and the other between two large bookcases on the opposite side of the enormous office. "What are those, anyway?"
"The one behind the bar was done by an old friend in Ranger Regiment. He was with me in Mogadishu," Sawyer said, examining the canvas from afar. "It's called the Mogadishu Mile. It is a reminder of how quickly circumstances can change."
"And that one?" Thwaite asked, taking a stiff drink.
"You don't recognize it?"
"Should I?"
"Remnants of an Army, painted by Elizabeth Thompson, Lady Butler, in 1879. It depicts the 1842 British retreat from Kabul to Jalalabad. Have you been there, Senator?"
"Afghanistan? Of course,"
the Senator said, removing the toothpick with three olives and sliding the first one between his yellowing teeth. "Jabad? Gardez? Khost? Abad?"
"Eric, you know I visited the troops on base in Bagram in 2004. You provided security. I also spent Thanksgiving in Iraq in 2009. I'm no stranger to war zones."
"Fallujah? Ramadi? Najaf?"
"No, the Green Zone," Thwaite said, making Sawyer's point.
"Ah, yes. I remember the photo op now."
"Fuck you, Eric. Some of us are soldiers and some of us are statesmen."
"I think you mean politicians."
"Don't say it with such disdain, Eric. Remember who pays for all this," Thwaite said, devouring his last two olives and gesturing to the grand office with his empty glass.
"Let me get you another."
"Thank you. If you weren't a hired gun, you would make an excellent bartender." Sawyer chuckled and set about making his guest a second drink. "What happened to our Lone Ranger, anyway?" Thwaite asked, nodding back at the famous oil painting.
"That's Dr. William Bryden. He was a surgeon. It was rumored that of the 16,000 who began the 70-mile retreat, he and his horse were the only survivors."
"True."
"There were, in fact, other survivors. Some straggled in after the good doctor. Others had been captured and enslaved, but survived. Regardless, the theme and intent of the painting holds true. The poor horse lay down in a stable in the Jalalabad fort and never got up. He, too, a casualty of the Afghan plains."
"Poetic."
"When you're wounded and left on Afghanistan's plains, go, go, go like a soldier," Sawyer recited.
"What's that?"
"No matter. The original painting hangs in Somerset, you know."
"Somerset?"
"Yes. The Somerset Military Museum, England. One day the original will hang here."
"Bloody depressing,"
the senator observed. "Just like in Mogadishu, the tide can turn in an instant, Senator, even against an empire. The enemy is always watching, always learning, always adapting."
"Dismal, if you ask me."
"Have you read The Great Game, Senator?" Sawyer asked, handing the older man his second cocktail.
"I don't have time to read, Sawyer. I am busy running a country."
"Pity. And one might argue that the current president is running the country, I'm afraid," Sawyer said, reminding Thwaite of his loss.
"Not for long. Turn it up, it's coming on now," he said, eagerly consuming all three olives that graced his refreshed drink.
The whore of war turned up the volume through his app and watched as the network led with the caption, "Presidential Assassin Targets Innocent Muslims."
"Is it taping?" Thwaite asked.
"Yes, the DVR is recording."
"Good."
The newscaster solemnly lectured his audience.
"We've received disturbing video this evening. Video that purportedly shows former Navy SEAL James Reese committing murder. These alleged murders are also classified as hate crimes.
You will remember Commander Reese from the Capstone scandal, where 3 years ago he went on a murderous cross-country rampage, killing those he believed were responsible for what some say were his own mistakes that led to the ambush of his SEAL team in the mountains of Afghanistan. Commander Reese was pardoned under dubious circumstances by the previous administration, so he never stood trial for those murders. I want to warn you, this footage may be disturbing to some viewers. A crisp image of whites, grays, and blacks filled the screen. Like an old black-and-white TV updated with 21st-century resolution, what was clearly a van parked just ahead of a smaller sedan on the right side of a road filled the screen. A man was leaning against the smaller car, his face and hands white against his darker clothing.
"White hot," Sawyer said.
"Excuse me?"
"It's a thermal imaging system from one of our surveillance vehicles. The hotter parts glow white. The colder areas are dark."
"Oh, yes, I know."
The conspirators watched as a man swung his feet over the guardrail and paused to look almost directly into the camera, his face taking on the aura of a ghoul, with the light and dark portions recreated by the camera in high-resolution pixelated heat. He stared for what seemed like an eternity before turning to move toward the two vehicles. They watched the figure walk along the side of the road and raise his rifle to his shoulder as he approached the sliding door of the van. The audio recorder picked up the shot, and the video caught the smoking man dropping to the ground.
"He indexed off the cigarette," Sawyer said.
"What do you mean?"
"It's dark. The man he killed was not a professional. Reese must have seen the cigarette in the darkness, which indicated head placement. He sighted on the cigarette and then fired a few inches left, hitting his target in the head."
"This is my favorite part," Thwaite said.
They had both watched the video multiple times before emailing it anonymously to multiple friendly news outlets with agendas in line with the senator's. This was the first network to air it. With his rifle still shouldered, Reese then turned to the front passenger window of the van and shot the driver through the glass, quickly stepping forward to shoot again.
"Security round," Sawyer said, sipping his drink. Thwaite grunted.
The ghost then walked to his first victim and shot him in the head. The screen then transitioned to video of a man who was clearly James Reese talking to a police officer and firefighter.
"This footage was obtained by Fox Illinois affiliate 32 News and depicts James Reese in Chicago at the home of Kareem Talib. Talib was a Muslim man who died of a heart attack while James Reese was at the scene. It is worth noting that it is common for serial killers to visit the scenes of their crimes and oftentimes keep mementos from their kills." The screen then switched to local news footage of police tape in a hallway of what looked to be a garden variety roadside hotel. The correspondent on scene reporting on the tragic death of Sohrab Behzad, a Muslim American man working at a local Atlanta mosque.
"We have new evidence tonight that puts James Reese on site at the time of the murder, along with statements from a woman who has verified that Commander Reese murdered Behzad before kidnapping her at gunpoint. She later escaped as he was driving her to a remote location."
The screen then ran a video of a man pushing a woman down a hotel hallway, a gun clearly visible in his hand. They then displayed a photo of Reese in his dress blues, clean-shaven, rows of medals on the chest of his flawless uniform.
"There are still unanswered questions tonight surrounding why Commander Reese would so deliberately target and kill these Muslim American men after meeting privately with the president at Camp David. The only connection between the deceased is that they are all devout Muslims of Middle Eastern descent. Commander Reese's behavior indicates a pattern of violence that fits with his murders following his last deployment. It also perpetuates a cycle of violence against those of Middle Eastern ancestry. Did post-traumatic stress or traumatic brain injury play a role in these killings? Is Commander Reese on another murderous rampage, this time connected to President Christensen's administration? We will continue to update you on what is still a developing story."
I couldn't have written that better myself,
Thwaite said, clearly pleased with the anchor's performance.
You did write it yourself, Eddie,
Sawyer said, hitting the mute button on his app.
That's right. I did,
the senator said, now even more pleased.
That should give the White House press corps something to pester the president and his press secretary about at Monday's briefing.
Senator, do you even care what Reese was doing in Chicago and Atlanta, or who this team was that targeted him in Maryland?
Those particulars are no longer my concern. That's an FBI issue now. This is politics. We muddy the waters with this tape, and the president is forced to do his job, to live up to his responsibilities as commander-in-chief, to eradicate the virus in Richardson and Aurora before it infects and kills 90% of the country. I mean, by God, there are now reported cases in Atlanta. Atlanta. They have isolated the patients thus far, but we know it's outside the containment zones. Can you imagine if he has to bomb Atlanta?
Sawyer remained silent and swirled the brown liquid in his glass.
We insinuate through our contacts in established media that he bombed Texas and Colorado to divert attention away from his association with Commander Reese.
Thwaite continued.
Like when President Clinton bombed Afghanistan and Sudan when Monica's blue dress stains were the talk of the town.
Ah, yes. Wag the dog. And what if he doesn't drop?
He has to drop, Eric. The country's finished if he doesn't. And I mean that literally. I don't envy him that decision, but we have an airborne virus threatening to destroy the country, possibly the world. Christensen can stop it. In fact, he's the only one who can stop it. It's political suicide, but it's his only viable decision. No one in Congress will publicly support him. They know he has to destroy two cities to save the Republic. Supporting it only takes them down with him. It simply has to be done. Only the commander-in-chief can make that call.
And the people of Richardson and Aurora?
It's truly heartbreaking, Eric. I don't know what else to say. Their deaths save the United States. Their deaths save the world. We will erect appropriate monuments and give speeches, sincere speeches. We will never forget their sacrifice, even though it's the only logical decision. Christensen is finished. His party will forever be known as the party that bombed America.
Yes, bombed America to save it, Sawyer pointed out.
But bombed it, nonetheless. There is no recovering.
And you benefit politically from these deaths?
Saul Alinsky said it best, never let a crisis go to waste. He was right, you know.
He didn't actually say that. He was much more eloquent, Sawyer corrected.
Oh, I know. Rahm Emanuel had to dumb it down for the masses, but the point remains.
Learning from your enemy, Senator?
That's not just for you military types, Eric.
Sawyer's secure desk phone rang.
Excuse me, Senator.
Can you bring me another drink while you are up?
Of course.
Sawyer took a seat behind the massive oak desk and picked up the receiver. He listened intently, then said,
Stay on them,
before hanging up and making the senator his drink.
Emergency?
Thwaite asked, as Sawyer handed him his third martini.
As a matter of fact, yes. James Reese and Dr. Haley Garrett just landed at Dulles. Reese placed a secure call to the CIA, which we intercepted. They believe they have evidence to suggest that the virus isn't airborne.
When the senator finished his tirade and finally left the building to return to his office to call the president, Sawyer bent down to pick up the broken shards of what just moments before was a chilled martini glass. Thwaite was prone to these outbursts when things did not go his way, but this latest tantrum was worrisome. Thwaite was convinced the virus was real and spreading. All the science suggested this was true. The liberal-minded president was looking for an excuse not to do his duty.
The senator believed Christensen was too weak to do what was necessary. The president was going to bring the republic down with him. He was going to destroy almost 250 years of freedom and sacrifice. James Reese was handing him the excuse he needed. For Thwaite, this was not a difficult decision. The few would be sacrificed to save the many. The country would survive. The senator's party would ascend to power once again, with Thwaite leading the way. He would take his rightful place and finally occupy the most powerful office in the land. Sawyer dropped the shards of glass in the trash and refreshed his cognac. Heading for his desk, he stopped and turned toward his bookshelf, approaching remnants of an army. He sipped his drink, examining the wounded doctor portrayed in the classic Victorian painting. Dr. Bryden was clearly in anguish. A section of his scalp had been removed by an Afghan blade in battle, his horse shot and near death. Sawyer turned to the large television. It was paused on the IR video of James Reese on the side of the Maryland Highway, rifle in hand, staring at the camera, the black-and-white image intensifiers giving him the look of a creature from hell. The former Army Ranger searched his book titles. There, next to a first edition of T.E. Lawrence's Revolt in the Desert, was the Peter Hopkirk classic The Great Game. Sawyer pulled it from the shelf and turned to Chapter 20. The book fell open easily at the binding, Sawyer having spent much time with it over his years of sending contractors to Central Asia. He read slowly, respectfully internalizing every word from a section titled Massacre in the Passes. Almost 100 miles of terror through snow-covered mountain passes, the army of Indus marched toward the British garrison at Jalalabad. Afghan warriors snatching souls at every turn, the savages tearing apart the 16,000 troops and camp followers as they pushed forward through freezing temperatures. Raids, sniper fire, horror. Until, a week later, one sole survivor was sighted approaching the fort, wounded on a dying horse. Sawyer looked at the television and then back at the painting. This time he saw something different. He saw himself on the horse, wounded, clinging to life, trying to make it inside the gates before being struck down. The savage Reese putting his finger to the trigger of a precision rifle, Sawyer in the crosshairs. The Navy SEAL sniper wasn't a man in this vision. He was an apparition, a black and white specter of death. He sat down at his desk and placed The Great Game to his left. Sawyer had been in the business of killing for most of his adult life. After Somalia, he'd learned how to profit from it. As with any enterprise, success in this business meant diversification. The lucrative U.S. military, intelligence, and diplomatic contracts might only last so long. Washington was a machine. The leadership of both political parties was fickle, all part of the same swamp apparatus, cogs in a deep state machine. In business, one had to remain on a trajectory of continual growth. Masada had expanded into worldwide mining security operations and training, advising, and assisting entities who could pay. Precious metals, conflict, diamonds, and oil all fell under the Masada profile and Sawyer's purview. On occasion, he had used certain men to solve problems. One of these men had a vested interest above and beyond money in seeing James Reese in the grave. Sawyer had used him over the past 2 years to eliminate problems in the Middle East and Africa. He was connected to the Russians and currently living in Montenegro on the Adriatic Sea. Sawyer pulled out a pen and paper and began to write a letter to enlist the services of a sniper. Chapter 60. Russell Senate Office Building, Washington, D.C. The fear and chaos that had gripped the nation had similarly engrossed the Capitol. Rumors were spreading that the executive branch was close to bold and devastating action to contain the virus in Richardson and Aurora. A mass exodus was underway in Atlanta while some took to the streets to take advantage of the lawlessness, looting and destroying at will. Speculation, conspiracy theories, and doomsday scenarios flooded the airways and social media channels. If you were against containment and eradication, you were branded as being for the death of the nation. If you were a politician in favor of those measures, you were in the position of supporting the deaths of your own constituents. Elected representatives from Texas and Colorado were in a state of paralysis. Every answer and decision tied to the virus was rooted in death. Ambassadors from countries not yet affected by the pathogen were clamoring for information. Representatives to the United Nations gave speeches calling for the United States to act to protect the global community of nations. Throughout the turmoil, the White House remained remarkably quiet, weighing the most momentous decision ever faced by an American president. Security, press, aides, interns, staff, senators and representatives, caseworkers, legislative correspondents, schedulers, and communications directors crowded the hallways as Senator Edward Thwaite made his way to his office in the Russell Senate office building. Leaving his assistant holding his coat, Thwaite barged past his receptionist and into his office, slamming the door behind him. He went right for the gin, attempting to make a martini of the same class he'd downed at Sawyer's building. He ended up foregoing the bitters and lemon twist and emptied what was left of his last bottle of Bombay Sapphire in a glass with ice and a dash of dry vermouth. Unable to find any olives, he swatted a cabinet shut and took a seat in his high-backed leather chair behind the same desk his father had used. It was up to him to save the country, save the world. He took two oversized gulps of his concoction to acquire some liquid courage before hitting the button for his receptionist.
"Karen, please connect me to the White House switchboard."
It still annoyed the senator that he did not have the president's direct line or cell number.
"Yes, Senator, right away."
Thwaite tapped his middle finger against his leather desk mat. After 5 minutes of tapping, he emptied his glass and began fidgeting with the cross pen he thought he'd be using to sign bills as president.
"Senator?"
"Yes?"
"The operator informed me that the president is not taking calls right now."
"What? In the middle of a national emergency, he's hiding in his bunker. Call back and tell the operator to put you through to the chief of staff. Wait, tell them to put you through to Greg Farber. Tell them this has national security implications that impact Richardson and Aurora, and that I have information on the reports connecting the president to Commander James Reese."
"One moment, Senator."
Thwaite's eyes surveyed his dark office, taking in the artifacts of two generations in the political spotlight. Photos of history-making legislative moments. Books he hadn't read. A portrait of his father.
"This could all be gone if the president doesn't take the necessary steps to save the nation. Delay means more death. Inevitably, the destruction of more cities. Richardson and Aurora, maybe even Atlanta, must be sacrificed to save the rest of us."
"Senator, please hold for the president,"
his receptionist said through the speaker. Thwaite straightened up in his chair, took the phone from its cradle, and cleared his throat. After 15 excruciating minutes, a voice from 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue said,
"Please hold for President Christensen."
A moment later, the leader of the free world's voice cracked across the line.
"Senator Thwaite."
Thwaite loosened the Windsor knot at his throat and pulled the tie to the side.
"Mr. President, thank you for taking my call."
"Of course. We are in the middle of weighing the options regarding the virus, so forgive me if I ask you to get right to the point."
"That is the purpose of my call, Mr. President. It has come to my attention that you may be delaying the inevitable and unenviable decision of eradicating the virus in Aurora and Richardson."
"That is a callous way of
referring to the deaths of 500,000 of our fellow countrymen, Senator.
I mean no disrespect, Mr. President,
Thwaites said, biting his tongue. Then you will understand why I remain dedicated to protecting the nation, including those in Richardson and Aurora.
Mr. President, if I may be blunt, without the sacrifice of two cities, you are putting the rest of the nation at risk. You are signing the death warrants of millions more. This is time for decisive leadership.
May I ask where you come by your information, Senator?
This town talks, Mr. President. If you waver from doing what needs to be done, my party will have no choice but to take our case to the American people. You are neglecting your duties as Commander-in-Chief, putting the future of the nation at risk.
Rest assured, I will do what needs to be done in the interests of the American people, and I will exhaust every effort to spare those innocent lives in Aurora and Richardson, the President responded, his tone cold and measured.
Every second you delay, the chances increase of the virus escaping containment.
Thank you for your counsel, Senator. I will take it under advisement. I was told you have information on tonight's story about Commander James Reese.
An unfortunate connection, I'm sure, Mr. President. An irresponsible news media running with only the hint of impropriety.
The President remained silent.
It would be devastating to the nation if the current emergency was compounded with a scandal. Some might say you took the drastic measures of destroying two entire cities to take focus away from your connection to a CIA assassin. The American people and your administration need to stay focused on the crisis at hand, stopping this virus.
Anything else, Senator? Thwaites had not managed to fluster the boy president in the least.
There is something else, Mr. President. I have sources who tell me that this murderer James Reese is connected to your administration and has concocted a theory that the virus is not airborne. I'd hate to think the president was taking medical advice from a discredited murderer when the fate of the nation and the world hangs in the balance. These latest murders I just watched on the news seem to fit a pattern for Commander Reese. Some might call him a serial killer. It would be best for everyone if he was locked up in the Supermax prison in Florence.
Senator, I want to thank you for your call of support. Before I go, I do have a question for you.
Yes?
Have you ever looked James Reese in the eye? Thwaites' mind drifted to the black-and-white image from the video, a specter looking straight through him.
No.